Your client is the director who awards maintenance contracts at her company. The tender for the next 3-year contract is still open. One of the bidders offers her £10,000, calls it a consultancy fee, and adds a fortnight's holiday for her family. The terms are plain. She is to see their bid home. She tells the board at once and takes nothing. The board is relaxed and asks you one question. Can we authorize her to keep it? No. Not by any resolution the board can pass. Working out why takes you through most of this topic. This is director's duties. 7 statutory duties, a handful of section numbers worth real marks, and one distinction that decides half the questions. Keep your client and her £10,000 in mind. Here is the route. Who counts as a director and to whom the duties are owed? Then the 7 duties in section order, from acting within powers to declaring an interest. Then what happens when one is broken? The remedies, ratification by the members, and relief from the court. Start with the architecture, because here the section numbers are the content. 7 general duties, sections 171 to 177 of the Companies Act 2006. Around them, 4 more. Section 170 says to whom they are owed. Section 178, what follows when one is broken. Section 239 is ratification by the members. Section 1157 is relief from the court. And here is the point that trips up more candidates than most. The duties are owed to the company, not to the shareholders. Section 170, subsection 1, says it in terms. The general duties in sections 171 to 177 are owed by a director to the company. The company is the proper claimant. So who is a director? Wider than you think. In the Act, director includes any person occupying the position of director by whatever name called. That is section 250. You cannot escape the duties with a different job title. De jure directors are appointed and registered at Companies House. De facto directors act as directors without any appointment and owe every one of the duties. Then, shadow directors. Section 251, a person in accordance with whose directions or instructions the directors are accustomed to act. 3 years of written instructions carried out without question is the paradigm. 2 things are not shadow directorship. Advice given in a professional capacity by a solicitor or an accountant is expressly excluded. So is a bank imposing conditions to protect its loan, which the board weighs and accepts. Under section 170, subsection 5, the duties apply to a shadow director so far as they can. Section 171. 2 limbs. Act in accordance with the company's constitution, and only exercise powers for the purposes for which they were conferred. Follow the rulebook and do not misuse the powers it gives you. The second limb is the one that gets litigated. Howard Smith Limited and Ampol Petroleum Limited, 1974. Directors issued new shares, diluting the majority shareholders' stake. The company had no need of the money. The real purpose was to defeat a takeover bid. The issue was invalid. Even though the directors honestly believed they were acting in the company's best interests, the power to issue shares exists to raise capital, not to manipulate control. So good faith does not save you. Good faith answers section 172. It is no answer to the proper purpose limb, and the court asks what the substantial purpose was, not whether some proper purpose was in the mix. Section 172, usually called the most important of the 7. A director must act in the way he considers in good faith would be most likely to promote the success of the company, for the benefit of its members as a whole. Read that again. In the way he considers. It is subjective, what this director believed, not what a court would have decided. But he must also have regard to six listed matters. Long-term consequences, the interests of the employees, relationships with suppliers and customers, the impact on the community and the environment, maintaining a reputation for high standards of business conduct, and acting fairly as between members. That is, enlightened shareholder value. The members are the destination. Those six are factors to weigh on the journey, not interests that displace them, and they need not carry equal weight. A board that closes a plant after commissioning and discussing a report on the workforce and the town has done what Section 172 asks.
Now, the modification examiners love.
When a company is in trouble, Section 172, subsection 3, engages what is called the creditor duty, and the Supreme Court settled its trigger in 2022. It bites once the directors know, or ought to know, that the company is insolvent, or bordering on insolvency, or that an insolvent liquidation or administration is probable. Note what is not enough. A real risk of insolvency at some future point does not engage it. That trigger was argued for and rejected. Once engaged, creditors' interests must be considered and balanced against the members, with more weight as the position worsens. They become paramount once an insolvent liquidation is inevitable. Section 173. Exercise independent judgment. Take advice, certainly, but make your own decision. The classic scenario is the nominee director, put on the board by an investor to protect the investor's interests. She owes her duties to the company, not to whoever appointed her. She may listen to her appointer, she may not vote, as instructed, without forming a view of her own. And the duty is not infringed by acting in accordance with an agreement duly entered into by the company or in a way the Constitution authorizes. Section 174. Reasonable care, skill, and diligence, with two limbs working together. The care of a reasonably diligent person with, first, the general knowledge, skill, and experience reasonably expected of a person carrying out the same functions. Objective. And second, the knowledge, skill, and experience this director actually has. Subjective. Why both? The objective limb is a flaw. You cannot fall below basic competence by pleading ignorance. The subjective limb raises the bar for the expert. So a chartered accountant who becomes finance director is judged by what his qualifications make possible. You are held to whichever is higher. Rita Jan of London Limited, 1994. A director signed an insurance proposal form without reading it. The form was wrong, the company claimed, and the insurer refused to pay. Negligent. A reasonably diligent director would have read it before signing, and he could not answer the charge by pointing at whoever put it in front of him. Two riders. A non-executive is subject to exactly the same duty, but the objective limb measures her against the functions she actually carries out, and you may delegate, but you may not abandon oversight. Directors who sign blank payment authorities unread have fallen below any standard. Section 175. Avoid conflicts. A director must avoid a situation in which he has or can have a direct or indirect interest that conflicts or possibly may conflict with the interests of the company. It applies in particular to exploiting any property, information, or opportunity. And note the sting. It is immaterial whether the company could have taken the opportunity itself. Bula and Bula, 2003. Two directors learned that a property next to the company's own was for sale. Without telling the board, they bought it personally through a company of their own. The company had already resolved to buy no more property. Breach anyway. The opportunity came to them as directors, so it was for the board to decide. The good news is that conflicts can be authorized. In a private company, the board may authorize, unless something in the constitution invalidates it. In a public company, the articles must expressly permit it. And the mechanics matter. It works only if the quorum is met without counting the conflicted director, and the decision is taken without his vote. So try one. Three directors, model articles, quorum of two. The conflicted director and one colleague turn up and both vote in favor. Effective? No. Disregard him, and one director attended. Inquirate, and the authorization fails. The conflict duty survives your resignation. Under Section 170, Subsection 2, a person who ceases to be a director stays subject to it for any opportunity he became aware of while in office. One director led negotiations for a contract, then heard privately that the client would take him, but not his company. He resigned, pleading ill health, signed the contract a month later through his own company, and had to account for every penny. Which brings us back to your client and her £10,000. Section 176. A director must not accept a benefit from a third party conferred by reason of being a director or of doing anything as director. Bribes, kickbacks, secret commissions. And here is the answer to the board's question. Unlike a Section 175 conflict, the board has no power to authorize a Section 176 benefit. None. The only relief is built into the section. The duty is not infringed if accepting the benefit cannot reasonably be regarded as likely to give rise to a conflict. So try another. A £2,500 weekend at a country hotel from a bidder while the tender is live. Or a £60 working lunch from a supplier who won a contract last year through a process she took no part in. Which can she keep? The lunch. The weekend is lavish hospitality from a bidder in a tender she controls, which is precisely the conflict the section is aimed at. And taking the £10,000 would expose her and the bidder to prosecution under the Bribery Act 2010. Section 177, the last of the seven, and the easiest to comply with. If a director is in any way, directly or indirectly, interested in a proposed transaction with the company, he must declare it. The nature and extent of the interest to the other directors before the company is committed. Indirectly is the word that catches people. A contract with a company owned by your spouse counts. Four situations need no declaration. You are unaware of the interest or the transaction. It cannot reasonably be regarded as likely to give rise to a conflict. The other directors already know or ought to. Or it concerns your own service contract, which the board will consider anyway. And do not confuse Section 177 with Section 182. Section 177 is the general duty and bites on proposed transactions. Section 182 covers a transaction already entered into, and failing to declare under that one is a criminal offence. Break a duty and what follows. Section 178 says the consequences are the same as would apply if the corresponding common law rule or equitable principle applied. In practice, damages, an account of profits, rescission, an injunction, and restoration of company property. And the duties are cumulative. under Section 179, more than one can apply to the same conduct, which is your client again. Had she taken the money and steered the award, she would have breached 4. Section 176, by taking the benefit. Section 175, by setting her interest against the company's. Section 172, by getting worse terms. And Section 177, by not declaring. Regal, Hastings Limited, and Gulliver is the case for the account of profits, and it is stricter than people expect. A director who exploits an opportunity that came to him as a director must account for the profit. It does not matter that the company lost nothing, or that it could not have taken the opportunity, or that he acted honestly and used his own money. Then, ratification. Under Section 239, the members can forgive a breach by ordinary resolution, but the wrongdoer cannot forgive himself. The votes of the director and of any member connected with him are disregarded, and spouses and children are connected persons. So work this one out. A sole director holds 55% and has sold a machine cheaply to his son's business. His son holds 10%. The other 35% is held by 2 members who will vote against. He proposes an ordinary resolution to ratify. Does it carry? No. Both his 55% and the 10% held by his son fall out of account, leaving only the 35% against. One hard limit. Once the company is insolvent, the members cannot forgive conduct carried out at the creditor's expense. The value in the company is the creditor's by then, not the members, to give away. Last, 2 safety valves. Under Section 1157, the court may relieve a director from liability, wholly or in part. The test is that he acted honestly and reasonably, and ought fairly to be excused. And under Section 232, a company cannot indemnify a director against liability to the company itself, though under Section 233, it can buy directors' and officers' insurance. A word on how SQE1 tests this. You will not be asked to recite a section number or a case name. You get a scenario, 5 answers, and 1 instruction. Pick the best. What the numbers buy you is speed. Knowing a conflict is 175 and a third-party benefit is 176 tells you at once which authorization rules apply, if you keep only 3. Howard Smith Limited and Ampol Petroleum Limited, for the rule that good faith does not cure an improper purpose. Bular and Bular, for the opportunity you must hand to the board, even when you are sure they will not want it. And Ree De Jan of London Limited, for the director who signed without reading. 4 traps. 1. A Section 175 conflict can be authorized by the board. A Section 176 benefit cannot. Candidates mix those 2 constantly, and the whole answer often turns on which one you are in. 2. A shareholder cannot sue in her own name for a fall in the value of her shares that merely reflects the company's loss. The duties are owed to the company. Her route is to ask the court for permission to bring a derivative claim on the company's behalf under Sections 260 to 264. 3. There is no lower standard of care for a non-executive director. The same duty applies, measured by the functions she actually carries out. 4. Watch the trigger for the creditor duty, bordering on insolvency or an insolvent liquidation probable. A real risk at some future point is not enough. Then, a habit for the exam. Name the duty, name the section, ask whether it can be authorized or ratified, and only then reach for a remedy. Quick check. Your client holds 15% of a private company and plays no part in running it. Over the past 2 years, its two directors have committed it to contracts no competent board would have accepted, and her shares have lost 2/3 of their value. The directors hold the rest of the shares and will not let the company sue. She wants her money back from them personally. 3 candidate answers. 1. She may sue the directors herself because the fall in her share value is her own loss. 2. She has no claim at all because the court will not review a board's commercial judgment. 3. She cannot sue in her own right, but may seek the court's permission to sue on the company's behalf. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is 3. The general duties are owed to the company alone, so the company is the proper claimant. A fall in share value that merely reflects the company's loss is not a separate loss she can recover. Where the wrongdoing directors control the company and block any claim, there is a route. A member may ask the court for permission to bring a derivative claim on the company's behalf under sections 260 to 264. Option 1 fails because the duties are owed to the company, not the members. Option 2 fails because terms no competent board would accept may well breach section 174. 5 things to take away. 1. The duties are owed to the company, not the shareholders, which decides who can sue. 2. The section numbers do the work. Section 171 powers, Section 172 success, Section 173 independent judgment, Section 174 care, Section 175 conflicts, Section 176 benefits, Section 177 declare. 3. A Section 175 conflict can be authorized by the board if the quorum and the vote exclude the conflicted director. A Section 176 benefit cannot be authorized at all, which is why your client cannot keep the £10,000. 4. On Section 174, you are held to the higher of what the role demands and what your qualifications allow. 5. Good faith is a complete answer to Section 172 and none at all to the proper purpose limb of Section 171. Next time, company meetings and resolutions. Practice this topic with exam-style questions at sqe1prep.co.uk. This episode is for education and exam revision only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the SRA or Kaplan.